This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Voter turnout in northern Kentucky during the May primary landed the local counties among the very bottom in the state. The statistic is repeatedly true election after election, despite the fact that northern Kentucky has more residents than Lexington, making it the second most populous region in the state. What keeps local voters home on election day? It may be more than lack of interest. Some barriers to voting may also hinder turnout, not only locally, but across the state and the nation. So let's talk about it. Joining Cincinnati Edition today are University of Kentucky College of Law professor Joshua A. Douglas. He's the author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. He joins us via Skype. Welcome, Josh.
Welcome. Thank you.
And Kenton County Clerk Gabriel Summey, who also joins us on the phone because she's in Frankfurt today. Welcome, Gabe.
Thank you.
Questions, comments, join this conversation, 513-419-7100, and weigh in on why you think voter turnout is low in northern Kentucky, or why you think it may be difficult to vote in Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana, or anywhere across the country. Our experts are here to chat with you about it. You can also email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. Gabe, let's start with you before we discuss Josh's book, because turnout in northern Kentucky was, again, very low in the May primary, even though statewide, the low expectation set by the Secretary of State's office was pretty well exceeded, but not here. So as county clerk, you oversee elections in Kenton County. Why do you think so few people turn out?
Well, we were in Kenton County at 11%. Campbell and Boone were very close in numbers. And I believe that a lot of that has to do with the fact that in northern Kentucky, when you have on the ballot, all the state, it was just the state races. There wasn't a whole lot of local things on there. Most of your state races, your governors, your secretaries at state, they don't spend a lot of money in northern Kentucky on advertising or any kind of campaigns. A lot of that has to do with how expensive our media market is. So when you don't get inundated with a lot of those campaign, you know, materials to your house or even anything on television, a lot of people don't know. And when they don't know, then they don't put it on their calendars. It's not something, and they always know in November, but they're never really aware of primaries. So you will see an uptick for the general election, though.
I think that's an interesting point that's often lost in this discussion, Gabe, is that, I mean, Northern Kentucky is part of the Cincinnati media market. All of the broadcast outlets are based in Cincinnati. So one, it's more expensive to advertise in Cincinnati than it is in Louisville or Lexington or the smaller communities across the state. But it also costs a lot, and a small percentage of the necessary voters are going to hear your message. What type of, I mean, you're an elected Republican. I imagine this is discussed at party meetings or something. I mean, what do candidates tend to say about it?
Well, they say exactly that. It's they don't get as much bang for their buck. And if they're going to, then it's a lot of grassroots. If they can, they go to a lot of specific partisan meetings, whether it's events that are specifically homed or housed or done by the Democratic Party and or the Republican Party, and that's how they utilize their dollars up this way. They will do mailers here and there, but again, getting into the advertising market is very difficult up our way, and unless there's somebody really local, like I know we had some local candidates on there, unless they really push something locally, people are just not paying attention because they've got so much coming at them by their phone, their TV, and in the mail, that if somebody doesn't make a concerted effort, nobody pays attention.
But this was a unique statewide primary in that both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, had some competitive races, both with the incumbent governor, Matt Bevin, facing a primary challenge that gained a lot more traction across the state than I think a lot of analysts expected, and also three strong Democratic candidates vying for that party's nomination. So were you surprised that the voter turnout still underperformed the statewide projection?
Not in northern Kentucky. Actually, we were close to the exact same percentage 4 years ago. So, and there was more money spent 4 years ago on the governor's race than was spent this time, I should say, spent in northern Kentucky than was this time, and the percentage was similar.
Well,
and exactly analyzing that, I'd need a little bit more statistics to find out their money, but what is creating that trend? I think people still are more engaged in what they think can happen to them locally, and that their vote has more impact on something locally than how they are can impact the state races.
Okay, before we dive into Josh's book, Gabe, do you know offhand, what's the cost typically to operate Election Day in Kenton County?
So I'm going to give an approximation because the prep is the same whether there's one thing on the ballot or 1,000 things on the ballot. So normally in a primary or a general, it's close to about $500,000.
Wow. $500,000 for 11% of the electorate to turn out. So, Josh, you wrote in your prologue to this book, it involves a story about a guy from Covington, and I'm going to read a little part of it. His name is West Powell, and it says, the problem that prevented him from voting was that over 25 years ago, Powell had made a dumb mistake. He had just graduated from Holmes High School in Covington, Kentucky, which is just south of Cincinnati, when he and his brother broke into an auto salvage yard and stole a car radio. He was caught and convicted of a felony. He served his time, met a woman, and started a family. He opened up his own computer repair shop, but he strived for more. But he lost his right to vote. And Josh, for a long time, people who were convicted of felonies were not permitted to vote any longer. In many cases, they still aren't. What type of impact did this institutionalized disenfranchisement have on the electoral process?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. You know, Kentucky is one of the worst states in the country when it comes to felon disenfranchisement because we disenfranchise people for life, regardless of the level of mistake they made, the kind of felony, and regardless of the kind of amends they've made or, you know, paying back their debt to society. And West Powell is just one among thousands of people who are really cut out of our democracy forever based on a mistake that they made years ago. Now, luckily for him, and, you know, the point of the story is that he was able to advocate and actually convince the Kentucky legislature to pass an expungement bill to allow some lower level felons to get an expungement of their records. But that took a sustained advocacy and, you know, it's really not good enough, although it is a success story.
So how many people in Kentucky do you know of that are impacted by this? Is there a percentage available?
Off the top of my head, I don't know the exact percentage of felons. I do know that it disproportionately harms African-Americans and that I think it's out of every four African-Americans in the state is disenfranchised. And it's a big problem, you know, especially because anytime you have someone cut out of the political process without a good enough justification, whether it comes from felon disenfranchisement or just barriers to the ballot box in general, then I think that's concerning for our democracy.
In your research for this book, which I'll remind listeners is called Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting, did you discover what the origin of this penalty was, this lifelong ban from being allowed to vote after being convicted of a felony?
Yeah, in most states, it comes from Jim Crow era laws that were intended to take away the right to vote to newly freed slaves. After the Civil War and when we're in the period of Reconstruction, states looked for various ways to disenfranchise African Americans, whether it came from literacy tests or other kinds of tests or devices to demonstrate that you're a qualified voter, or the increase in certain kinds of things that became felonies along with a felony disenfranchisement law that was really disproportionately intended to harm African Americans. And that legacy continues to this day.
Josh, what do you view as the biggest hurdle to voting in general in the United States?
Well, you know, I think there's lots of steps in the process that we can break down, whether it comes to voter registration deadlines, like in Kentucky, where you have to register 30 days before the election or you're cut out of the system. And, you know, in this day and age of technological advances, I'm not sure we need that kind of lead time. Election day itself being not as accessible. Kentucky, we vote 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., and there's no early voting. There's no little ability to get an absentee ballot, at least without an excuse. Other states do it a lot better, where they have much easier access to the ballot box, and that, you know, makes a big difference. And then we can talk about structural issues like, you know, gerrymandering, the practice of drawing district lines to really favor one party or the other, which makes a lot of voters feel like it's not even worth it to show up because the system is already deciding who's going to win. And I think there's a lot of different things that we could talk about, and they all combine to get this woefully low turnout.
Do you expect that the cases before the Supreme Court will bring about a day of reckoning for the gerrymandering that, of course, benefits both parties, depending on which part of the country we're talking about? Both parties use it to their advantage. Do you think that there's going to be some significant change?
I'm not sure about significant. So there's two cases before the Supreme Court right now, one out of North Carolina and the other out of Maryland. If the court does anything, I suspect that perhaps they'll do something about the Maryland case, which is kind of a narrower challenge and would, you know, reduce kind of the worst egregious cases of partisan gerrymandering. The North Carolina case deals with the map as a whole, as opposed to one district. We're getting a little bit into the legal weeds here, but the bottom line is if the court does anything, I think it'll be on very narrow grounds.
Gabe, you heard Josh reference the hours that the polls are open. Now, this is a statewide issue. And really, in presidential election years, for example, Kentucky tends to be passed over. The federal candidates tend to know which side of the Electoral College Kentucky's votes are going to fall. But there's that one exciting moment for Kentucky voters when we know that our votes are going to be counted first. So that part's exciting. But do you think that the hours that were open, even though it does allow us to count our votes quickly and first, do you think the hours that were open presents a problem to voters?
Yes and no. And here's why. First of all, the way that Kentucky is structured, and I want to speak to something else that was referenced, has a lot to do with the way that technology is set up and a lot of the equipment we have, also the way that we are structured as far as precincts. And you have to man those precincts. And right now people were open from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., but really people are there at 5 a.m. to set up to open at 6 a.m. And anyone who's in the facility by 6 p.m. can vote, and that can mean till, and it did in the presidential, sometimes up to 8 o'clock at night before you're actually able to close the polls. So we're not, during those time frames, ever really restricting anybody's ability to get there. Now, as far as really looking at the complete structure, one of the things you also have to consider is Kentucky is kind of a decentralized system, very different from a lot of other states, in that the Secretary of State in a lot of the other states is not only the person controlling everything that happens on a local level, they also pay for it. In the state of Kentucky, your counties are the ones who are actually paying the cost of the elections on behalf of the state. So that is a more direct cost as it relates to your local governments. So when you're looking at elections, and what I mean, yes, is there a better way to do it? Most likely. But you also can never take out the factor of how do you pay for that? Where does that money come from? How do you do that? And a lot of people say, well, it's our right to vote. You know, money shouldn't be an option, an issue. And I say, I agree. But at the same time, you can't never consider it an issue because at some point, how does it get paid for? How do you logistically put all these things together so that you do make sure people have that option of getting to vote? And a lot of that discussion is going on a lot at the Kentucky legislature about voting hours and how you restructure precincts and, you know, your timing. And to speak to the first thing that Josh said, which is, why do we have such a long lead time? One of the things is that we are just recently having a more modern technological system with the State Board of Elections. And we're using e-poll books, but that is not statewide yet. And when you come into I'm just going to use Kenton County as reference, is I have 20 cities. So when someone registers to vote, I still have people who have to make sure that they're in the right city and the right school board and the right representative district and all of those things. So that does take a little time, and it's still a human component that is making sure people are in the proper place so they can vote on the proper things. So there does always have to be a little lead time. I don't know, given how complicated Kentucky's setup is, whether there would ever get to a point where you would be able to have a true same-day registration.
Kenton County is
yes, I think
you have a very complicated county there. County Clerk Gabe Summey there in Kenton County, the third most populous county in the state. Geographically, though, one of the smallest, and yet you do have all those different boundaries in there to deal with, which involves municipal elections, districts for countywide offices. You have school boards all over the place and a lot going on there. And the other interesting thing, of course, for Kentucky County Clerks is that they have to do elections. They had to do them in 2018. They have to do them this year, and they're going to have to do them next year. There is a proposal, though, that has had support in multiple General Assembly cycles to line up Kentucky elections with the federal ones, particularly the presidential elections, to see if that would draw more voters to the polls and save some money. We're going to talk about that next as we continue this discussion. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Is voting too difficult here? And what about across the country? A new book explores some of the challenges at the ballot box. Let's continue now with University of Kentucky College of Law professor Joshua A. Douglas. He's the author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. And we're also joined by Kenton County Clerk Gabriel Summey. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show. Josh, just before we went to break there, I referenced that Kentucky statewide elections for the state's most important offices, the constitutional ones, governor, attorney general, secretary of state, those all happen in odd numbered years as opposed to being lined up with congressional races or presidential years. Do you think this is a negative barrier for voters in the state?
I do, Michael, because, you know, every time you have more elections, especially in an odd numbered year, you have fewer people turning out. You know, one argument in favor of elections in odd number of years is that perhaps the state's voters are more focused on that election and that election only. But if you look at elections in other states that line them up with, say, midterm congressional elections in even numbered years, I don't think you have less focus on the state races, and yet you do have higher turnout. And, you know, my goal in all of the reforms I propose in the book is simply to improve turnout among all voters. And I do think Kentucky suffers from low turnout. Look, 31% in 2015, the last time we elected our governor, is just, you know, a really sad state for a democracy.
And Gabe, I want to ask you that as well. I imagine, the argument from Senator Chris McDaniel, who represents most of Kenton County and Frankfort, including Covington, is that this would save money at the local level. Would changing the year in which we vote for the statewide offices save some money for your office?
Absolutely. I don't know. I mean, you also have to consider some of the rules and regulations as it relates to certain things that trigger special elections. So that may happen. But at the same time, I do believe that it would increase turnout, and I do believe it would save a great deal of money on your county level.
Okay. Why don't we have automatic voter registration in Kentucky, Gabe?
Well, right now, I just don't think it's feasible, just based on some of the conversations that we had about, how long it takes, depending on how. I still have a lot of handwritten documents that come to me. I have things that come via online or driver's license. I also have things that come from your social service agencies, and I need time to process those because sometimes I'm literally typing things into a system and then, of course, making sure that they are properly coded, meaning they're in the right city with the right school board, with the right districts, so that I know what ballot that person's supposed to receive, and also then notifying the voter where they need to be. If at some point in time you get to a point where, you know, you have bigger districts and you're able to program a computer system that would allow for that automatic generation, that might happen. And I wouldn't necessarily be opposed to it as much as it would be logistically right now. I'm not sure it would be very feasible.
Josh, what did you find in your prep work for your book and in the writing of the book in relation to automatic voter registration?
Yeah, automatic voter registration is a great reform started in Oregon, where they registered over 100,000 new voters who otherwise wouldn't have been registered. This is, you know, where the state takes information from a state database like the DMV office and uses the information it has there and essentially lets that database talk to the voter registration database and transfers over all of the relevant information. This spread to places like Georgia and West Virginia. And so what we've seen is that it's very popular. It's in either been passed or being implemented in over a dozen states now, both so-called red and so-called blue states. And the result has been really both improved turnout because more people have are on the voter rolls and don't have that, I didn't realize I had to register 30 days in advance problem. It also helps to clean up the voter rolls dynamically because every time someone interacts with a DMV to, say, update an address, that information is automatically transferred over to the voter registration rolls. So this is really a win-win for lowering costs, improving turnout, and making the system a lot more convenient and inclusive.
513.
Well, Kentucky already has registration through Motor Voter.
Well, every state does. That's federal law.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So every state has voter registration through the DMV. The question is, does it happen automatically or does the voter have to opt in? And in Kentucky and many other states, the voter has to take the affirmative step of doing so. What AVR does is take that requirement that the voter does it him or herself away, and the state automatically does it. The state has responsibility, and that makes a big difference for many voters.
Right, but in all states, I cannot be a U.S. citizen and get a driver's license, so I would still have to let them know that I want a driver's license, but I'm not able to vote because I'm not a American citizen.
Yeah, absolutely right, and the AVR system takes that into account in the states that have used it.
And Josh, is opting in such a burden?
Yeah, I mean, it is because it's an additional step that you have to take. And if the right to vote is the most fundamental, important right in our democracy, then we shouldn't be putting up hurdles for people to have to jump over. And so, yes, opting in, I mean, what we see in the states that have used it is that thousands upon thousands of voters who otherwise would not have been on the voter rolls and likely wouldn't have shown up are being registered through automatic voter registration. So the proof is in the pudding, as they say, when it comes to the result in places like Oregon and West Virginia and Georgia.
All right, let's check out the phone lines. We have Matt on the line. Hi, Matt. What's your question or comment?
Hi. So my comment is about when you get to the ballot box and you thought that you knew what was going to be on the ballot box and who you were going to vote for, but you see all these people who are running and you're like, oh, wait a minute. I'm voting on all these things, and it's kind of a shock. I used to live in Covington, and now I live in Fort Thomas, and I had the same issue in each one where I thought I was researching and I was figuring out who I was going to vote for. But when you get to the ballot box, you're just kind of blown away by, oh, God, there's all these different people that I didn't realize I was going to have to vote for. And when I used to live in Oregon, I lived in Portland, Oregon, and the way that they do it there is they mail you the ballot, and it has the who's running, the people's positions on various subjects that pertain to their office, and it has the ballot, and all you got to do is, you know, you do your personal research, but then you also have all of this research that adds to an informed voter. That's my comment.
Matt, we appreciate the call very much. I'll turn over to Gabe, because what type of sample ballots are you sending out to voters?
So we don't automatically send ballots out to voters. The sample ballot is, of course, available. We try to put them on our system. When it's a simple ballot, like Democrat versus Republican, that's simple. Again, I have normally on a regular ballot 52 different ballot faces. So that would, again, be something that I do make available on my website, but anyone who would be seeking that would have to go to the website to see it, because it would be logistically not something that would be very easy for me to do or cost effective for the county.
Because, for example, when I grew up in South Covington, which is a strange part of the city of Covington because it doesn't look like the rest of the city. It's a little more suburbanized, and it touches the more suburban cities of Taylor Mill and Independence. And my first vote cast as an 18-year-old was at Oak Ridge Church, and multiple cities vote in that same location. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
So like you have Covington, you might have an independence precinct there at some point. Latonia Lakes will vote there as well. So I can imagine that it would be complicated for you to narrow down where exactly you're going to be mailing those ballots.
Yes. And I try to reach out actually through you and any of the other media to encourage people to be able to take that time to go look to see what I have. I'm happy for people hopefully getting to the point where we can start, you know, getting email addresses where if somebody calls me, I can easily turn it into a PDF and send it to them. All of this is also available on the Secretary of State's website as well for the whole state.
I want to know about voting centers, Josh, and you write about the power of convenience involving vote centers. I'll read a quote from your book. The idea is actually quite simple. Instead of having to visit a precinct based on one's home address, why not allow someone to vote anywhere in the county? A voter might find it more convenient to vote closer to work or school. So if that is as simple as it sounds in that writing, Josh, why doesn't it happen?
Well, it's starting to happen more and more. So vote centers are now the reality in Colorado. It started in Larimer County, Colorado, thanks to a Republican county clerk there who had the idea and basically said, you know, why can't voting be as convenient as food shopping? I can go to any supermarket in wherever I am and find basically the same thing. And so he drew up a model of voting, and I tell the whole story. And I guess this is a good point also to mention that, you know, my book is all about the stories of individuals who have come up with these reforms. And they're all connected electronically, these vote centers. So if you check into one place, you can't go anywhere else in the county. And the ballot that's printed for you there is the ballot for your home address. So, you know, what this does is actually reduces costs too, because there are fewer vote centers that can process more voters. The voters there seem to love it. It's improved turnout. And so this is the reality in all elections in Colorado, as well as a handful of other places that have adopted them, like counties in Indiana and Kansas and some others. So this really makes a lot of sense.
And Gabe, I'm curious what your thoughts on that might be. I know sometimes, depending on the year or the situation, you may have to move precincts or close precincts. And I know that's a challenge for you. Do you think having just general voting centers would be helpful?
Oh, I think that it's an excellent idea and an excellent model, and I think everybody has to have that flexibility to do what's right for their citizens. Canton County, again, because that's my county, we have an inner city, we have a large population that's suburban, and then we have rural. So voting centers makes a lot of sense for my more suburban areas, but I do still have to accommodate or might have smaller precincts available for anybody who might have to take a bus or walk or something of that nature. And I want to be able to see what the citizens would want to see in that circumstances so that I would make sure I was addressing those population needs. Even though it is more cost effective, I still want to be able to have what was going to work best for the individuals in those particular areas.
And Michael, can I add something really quickly?
Sure, go ahead, Josh.
Colorado has a great model where they use both universal vote by mail, also known as vote at home, what Matt, your caller, was mentioning, and vote centers. So every voter receives a ballot 2 or 3 weeks before Election Day they can fill out. And if they choose not to do so at home, then they can go to one of the vote centers in the county. And that really, sort of this hybrid system, makes a lot of sense.
And I know we just got about a minute left, and I want to get one more question into both of you. And Gabe, I just want to know, you're in Frankfort today. What's next for the evolution of voting in Kentucky?
Well, this summer, and the Kentucky County Clerks Association really worked very well together because, you know, we're very nonpartisan, even if we have specific parties behind our names, very nonpartisan group. And we are looking at, what is it going to do to make it better for voters? We truly are focused on that. So we are actually going to be meeting here very soon to start looking at what is it about our statutes, what is it that we can change that would allow us to have a little bit more flexibility to do what's best for our counties based on what our citizens are looking for. How do we make things a little easier? One of the things, the reforms we did last year, was being able to actually, even though absentee voting is still the law in Kentucky, easier ways of getting things to the citizen at their home. We're allowed to now email the application versus putting it in the mail, which now saves tons of days before they have to mail it back to us. The live ballot is still mailed. But we're looking at all those little things that we can do to make it easier for the voter and encouraging that connection with us.
And Josh, what do you think will be the most surprising takeaway for people who read your book? And we'll give you about 30 seconds for that.
I think the most surprising thing is that there are a lot of positive voting rights reforms happening in various places around the country, in you know, both so-called red and so-called blue places, where we're making it easier, more inclusive to vote. And these things are actually working, and we just need to expand them.
Our thanks to Joshua A. Douglas. He's a University of Kentucky College of Law professor, and his new book is Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. And also Kenton County Clerk Gabriel Summey. Thanks to you both for the very good discussion.
Well, thank you, Michael.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. I'm Michael Monks. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org.